Good afternoon. Thanks for keeping it on WGN Radio. I'm G, short for G Suki, on the Winterest Business Lunch. So grateful that you're listening and joined us. We've got a great show for you today. Tax advice, especially if you're working in the gig economy, whether you're driving Uber or Lyft. We've also got advice on how to improve your relationship with your boss, and also co-founder of that irreverent Chicago-based card game company, Cards Against Humanity. Max Temkin will be joining us as well. But let's get started and get down to business with Veronique Darougi. She is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She's a nationally syndicated columnist. She writes a lot about the U.S. economy. Her research also includes specializing in the federal budget, taxation, and she's testified numerous times in front of Congress. So Veronique is the perfect person to join us and give us her perspective on the State of the Union address. Hi, Veronique.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you join us. So not a big surprise that the president dived right into the state of the economy at the top of the speech. Did you gain any insight in terms of economic policy from listening to the speech?
Not really in terms of what he's going to do for the economy, except for doubling down on a lot of things that he's done before, some of them good and some not so good. But, I mean, let's give credit where credit is due. While the recovery started and was well on its way before President Trump took office, and even his economic growth rates are not as unusual as he often claims. I mean, the policies that he has put in place in some areas have actually really done something that very few people mention, which is it has extended a recovery beyond a point that we usually see. I mean, there's a cycle to the economy, and often roughly every 6 or 7 years, we get a recession. It doesn't mean it's a terrible fall, but it's a recession, and he's getting us really way past this point, and some of it is because of his tax cuts and deregulation, and also his positive attitude towards businesses, which I think gives them kind of a feeling that things are going to flourish rather than go poorly.
In terms of the to-do list for what he has remaining to do, what do you see? What are the tasks that remain on the economic to-do list for him?
Well, so I was really happy to hear him talk about school choice. I mean, it seems like, I mean, as kind of a concern for every American, it's about, you know, parents care about where their kids go to school, and every parent has a right to be able to actually put their kids in the kind of educational system that they feel will help their child flourish. So that was great, but I was disheartened to hear him double down on his trade policies. I mean, let's not forget that the two trade deals that he highlighted yesterday, I mean, they're not what they're claimed to be. I mean, USMCA, which is a replacement for NAFTA, is not really a replacement for NAFTA. It's roughly like 90 to 95% of USMCA is the old NAFTA, right? And there are a lot of very protectionist measures in there, and there are some modernization, and they kind of like cancel each other in terms of net benefit and cost. So it's not spectacular, USMCA, and the Chinese deal that we've gotten is again, it's pretty face saving. I mean, it doesn't have strong structural reforms or ways to get the Chinese to commit on IP. And let's not forget the tariffs are still up. And for all the claim about manufacturing doing well, I mean, it has taken a real serious hit. And the reason is that basically, like, companies pay it's companies, American companies, that pay these tariffs, right? And the other things that have been, you know, really counterproductive is that one of the things that was going to be really great about the tax cut is that the corporate income tax rate was going to increase dramatically, in theory, capital expenses. And they did in 2018, but then as the tax war or the trade war went on its way, you saw capital expenditure actually start to not only just reduce in the growth of their increase, but then collapse. And that is a real problem, not only because it's not good for the economy, and though the economy is doing well, it could be doing way better, but it's also because then the Democrats can point at this particular thing and say, see, look, the tax cuts didn't work.
Got it. So definitely some negatives and also some positives, including the unemployment rate, which is the lowest in a half a century. Thank you so much, Véronique Darougi, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Please come back and join us again. Wintrust Business Lunch, G here, joined now by Christine Cheng. She's the executive director of a nonprofit called Ladder Up. Yes, it's true. It is officially tax season, started last month on the 27th. And Christine has joined us to give us some tips for avoiding delayed refunds in 2020. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us. So give us some of these tips. I definitely don't want a delayed refund.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the big things that's sort of new for this tax season is there were some recent IRS processing changes, which means that a mismatch in data, and I'll explain, you know, some examples of that, is leading to taxpayer refund freezes. And these freezes are averaging right now about 11 weeks. And so a mismatch some of the prime examples would be an income mismatch. So maybe you forgot that you had this little W-2 from a smaller job you did for part of the year. You file without it. There's an IRS mismatch, right, because IRS has those, you know, earnings records on file. This would then lead to this refund freeze. So there's a big campaign on behalf of the IRS Taxpayer Advocate Service for sort of get it right the first time. So when you're filing, include all of your income, you know, be careful about the, you know, exactly how much withholdings, you know, making sure, you know, what you're entering in your software, what you're telling your preparer matches what you have on your documents, making sure that all of your names, social security numbers, birth dates that appear on the return are all correct, really to avoid what can be a very, very detrimental freeze on a refund.
Talking with Christine Cheng, she's the executive director of Ladder Up. And Ladder Up is a nonprofit, and you've partnered with the city. I'm hearing you have hundreds of volunteers across the city as well. Can you tell us what Ladder Up does?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a Chicago-based nonprofit organization founded here in 1994, and really everything that we do is to work to help hardworking families and individuals access the financial resources they need to move up the economic ladder. So that takes a lot of different forms in terms of the free services we offer out to the families in the community, but kind of related to tax time, we have a very large tax assistance program. And as you mentioned, in partnership with the city, we operate 15 different tax sites across the city. We also offer some in some of the suburban communities surrounding the city. And we have hundreds of volunteers who we have trained, who have passed an IRS certification test, and who are out there to offer tax prep for free to qualifying families and individuals.
So you have to qualify in order to receive this free tax help.
That's right. That's right. So all of the eligibility is available on our website, which is goladderup.org. But in general, the biggest one is just in upper income limits. So we generally serve most families who are earning up to $56,000 annually. And for individuals, that upper income limit is $30,000 annually. And then there are a few sort of scope-related points of eligibility, but that's most people want to know what are the income limits.
That's fantastic. And the website, again, is goladderup.org.
That's right. Yes.
Okay. So any other tips? You say look for, make sure you're not having any sort of earnings mismatches, because that will definitely hold up your refund. Any other tips?
Certainly, this relates to a different kind of refund delay, which has been around for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. Any taxpayer who's claiming the Earned Income Tax Credit, also known as the EITC or the EIC, or the additional child tax credit, the IRS is going to hold that refund for that taxpayer until February 15th, regardless of when before February 15th they file, to ensure that there aren't fraudulent payments of these credits. And that means kind of the real-life impact of that is if you are one of those taxpayers who's claiming one of those two credits and you file before February 15th, you will not see your refund until late February if you chose direct deposit, and if you chose a paper check, well, then even later than that point in time. So that's sort of a sort of a PSA note that if you're one of those taxpayers who's affected, your refund will not come as quickly as you might have seen in past years. And so from a budgeting perspective, that's just something we want people to be aware of.
But Christine, the earned income tax credit, you say, is something that a lot of Chicago taxpayers don't take advantage of.
Right. So the national estimate from IRS and some other sources is that potentially 20 to 25% of taxpayers who are eligible for the earned income tax credit are potentially not claiming it, which can, of course, I mean, the earned income tax credit is, you know, widely lauded as one of the most successful anti-poverty programs in our country, bipartisan support for over 40 years. You know, some taxpayers who are qualifying for this credit are receiving, through this credit alone, over $6,500. So it can be an enormous credit that really helps people meet basic needs and save for the future, but there is a segment of people who is just not claiming it for a whole host of reasons.
Christine, why do you think that is?
It's a varied set of reasons why. Some of it is awareness, not knowing that the credit is out there. Sometimes it's a change in a personal situation. So maybe last year you weren't qualified for the credit, or maybe previously you've never been qualified for it, but something, you know, in 2019 sort of changed that. Now you are eligible, but you didn't even know to look for it because you had never gotten it before. So those are some of the factors. There are some other ones as well, and there's a lot of research looking into this right now, is how can we increase uptake of that credit, but those are some of the reasons.
Can you summarize who would be qualified for an earned income tax credit?
Yeah, there are some pretty specific income limits. You know, so this is a credit that actually is offered to a lot of families earning up to about $56,000, which is why that's our upper income limit for service. And really where you see the credit max out is really for those taxpayers who are within the income range and who have qualifying children for the credit. So there's actually a lot of detail about this. There's an EITC assistant on the IRS website, irs.gov. That's really great in terms of you can go there and say, okay, this is my situation. Am I qualified for this credit?
Of course, a lot of folks are driving Lyft or Uber or Via. That's all part of the gig economy. Can you explain what the gig economy is?
Sure. So this would be, right, like you were saying, people who are doing sort of these, you know, part-time gig, side hustle, whatever you want to call it, driving for Uber or Lyft,
yes,
like you said, or
calls.
Delivering for Amazon, Grubhub, you know, whatever it may be. And I think what we see a lot at our tax site certainly is, especially when it's the first time that that person has filed their taxes since starting that kind of gig work, is this sort of unwelcome news that, oh, that gig work is actually self-employment income on
yes.
which you need to pay self-employment taxes. So that can be sort of a rude awakening for some people who just thought, oh, it would be just like when I'm an employee and I get a W-2, my employer pays their share of the taxes and I do some withholdings, you know, and I'm sort of all caught up on taxes. That's not the case with self-employment income. There is a self-employment tax that people are going to have to pay. There's some additional detail on our website, too, about, you know, taxpayers who are expecting to owe $1,000 or more in self-employment tax ought to be paying the IRS those taxes quarterly, and they can set up a plan to pay, you know, exactly one quarter of their expected tax each, you know, every 3 months to keep that kind of pay-as-you-go system working. So that's increasingly something that we see and have get asked about.
Wow. So if you drive Uber or Lyft or Via, that might be news to you. So that's very
right.
important. Thanks for that tip. The website is goladderup.org. The requirements in order to get the free tax help, it is all on the website. What if someone's listening and they want to help volunteer? Do you take on volunteers right now?
Absolutely. So it's a little bit towards the end of our training window for volunteers. So we provide all the training to our 1,000-plus volunteers who help out with our tax assistance program. You don't need to have a tax or a finance background to participate. But we are sort of a little bit at the tail end of that training window. We really start up training in December, and it's really heavy for, you know, late December through all the way through January into the front part of February. But again, anybody who's interested in volunteer opportunities can also visit our website. That's really the core of how we do our services. As an organization, we prepared about 23,000 tax returns last year. it wasn't just our little 20-person staff. It was the 1,100 volunteers who gave their time and their skill to serve other people in the Chicagoland community.
Well, Christine Cheng, Executive Director of Ladder Up, you guys are doing some great work. A lot more coming up on WGN Radio. G here with the Winterest Business Lunch, joined now by Tom Gimble. He is the CEO of LaSalle Network, which, if you don't know, is a top employment agency performing staffing and recruiting services for leading companies and helping candidates find jobs and careers. How are you, sir? It's
I'm
been a little while.
A little bit. How you been?
Very good. New Year treating you right?
Knock on wood. No problems yet. You can't see me knocking my head.
I think this is the first time I'm seeing you in 2020, but I'm not allowed to say Happy New Year because it's already February.
You know what?
Those are the rules.
People get a little upset over
certain things
in society. Happy New Year.
Well, Tom, Valentine's Day, can you believe it, is fast approaching us.
Right.
And who knew that you were a relationship guru?
Exactly right. It's a new feather in my cap, G.
But in a way, you really are, because we're talking about relationships between employees and their managers and their CEOs. This is an important relationship.
Relationships are, there's parallels in all relationships. And whether it's your partner, somebody you just met, a manager, a coworker, like you said, you have to put in effort. You know, and I think someone thinks, well, you're getting paid, so have a great relationship, which is ridiculous. Just by saying it out loud, I feel dumber. It's like you have to invest time and emotions to have a real, you have to be, you know, it's there's buzzwords, Brene Brown and all this stuff, right?
Yes, Brown, I love her.
She's great. Your authentic self, mm-hmm. right? And are you willing to give of yourself and share the problems?
Okay, so we spend so much time at work, a lot more time at work sometimes than we do with our family at home.
For sure.
So if you don't have a great relationship at work, especially with your manager or your boss, it can really affect your everyday life.
Absolutely.
So how do we fix it?
There is a holistic part to this. And for those naysayers saying you shouldn't spend as much time at work as you do at home, well, remember, you can't afford the home without the work.
Yes. And so how do we fix it if we maybe don't see eye to eye with our manager, or we are having difficulty communicating?
So you ask this question of yourself as if somebody was asking it to you, and you say, whose fault is that the relationship isn't better? And if the answer is theirs, then you know that you are the problem.
Really?
Well, sure. If you're not going to take accountability of any aspect of it, if you're your boss could be the biggest jerk in the world. If you don't own any aspect of it, you are the problem. You can soften a hard substance.
This is like pointing a finger at someone, and there's three fingers pointing back at you.
Yeah, there really is. So if it is, the question is, are you over-communicating with your manager? And there are people that really, literally over-communicate. Maybe you need to pull back. But really, most people will say, I don't want to be micromanaged. Well, if you over-communicated, they wouldn't need to ask you a million questions.
Now, Tom, I think what you're saying is that regardless of the situation, there's something that the employee can do to try to remedy the situation.
Absolutely. If you're unhappy with the situation, if you don't like the money, if you don't like the title, you don't like the role, you don't like your boss, what are you doing to improve it? So I say to everybody, at the end of every week, do you write 4, 5, 6, 7 bullet point summary of your week to your boss and send it in an email? Hey, just want to let you know, this is what I accomplished and this is where I'm at. If you're not doing that, and you aren't happy with the relationship, then own that.
So that's a suggestion. So maybe, so repeat that again.
So if you're not happy in the situation, if you want to have a better relationship with your boss, at the end of the week, on Friday afternoon or Saturday morning, if you're that type of person, but write an email and say, hey, G, just wanted to let you know I got through A, B, and C, D, E, and F. I'm about 50% of the way through. I need a little bit of help on F. Can you please get some time next week to meet with me? Otherwise, I think I've got it covered. And you send that off, and all of a sudden, your manager's like, hey, wait, what? This is unbelievable. I'm getting you're establishing new rules to the game.
It's like a mini performance review, and you're also encouraging feedback as well.
It's a status update. So the question is this. If you were going to the hospital, if somebody you loved was in the hospital, and the doctor never talked to you about what was going on, but they were treating your loved one terrifically, but you never were updated, you wouldn't know that it was going well. But if at the end of the week or the day, the doctor sent you a note or came out and talked to you and said, hey, just want to let you know, A and B are really good. We're a little worried about C, and we'll give you another update tomorrow. You'd be like, wow, thank you. I feel better. even if it's bad news, I feel better knowing versus not knowing.
Does this ever open up a manager to then say to you, or for a manager to find areas that you can improve in?
God bless him. I'm not a religious guy. God bless America. If your manager gives you feedback on where you can improve, that means they actually care about you and want you to do better. When your manager doesn't give you constructive or literally negative feedback, that means they're not being honest with you, because we all can be better.
So see that as a positive.
It is a positive. If they ignore you and don't give you any feedback, that's not a good thing.
So you have to ask yourself, if you're the employee, are you meeting and exceeding expectations? And obviously we want to exceed.
We're all human beings. The majority of us don't exceed in a lot of things, right? We don't exceed on our dieting. We don't exceed on our exercise. We don't exceed in our relationships, right? We all know we should be better with friends. But at work, we're great. It's the manager's fault. The clients are bad. But I'm great. It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. We can always be better. We can always be stronger. And we want to know, what areas can I be better at?
And I think this is important, too, because this tends to be about taking accountability and ownership. And the majority of what we can control in this life is ourselves.
Do you know why most employees don't ask what they can do better?
Because they're afraid?
No.
Why?
Yes, but not for the reason you think. They're afraid they're actually going to have to do more work to be better.
Oh, I thought they might be afraid of negative feedback.
They don't want to put in the effort on what the feedback is.
So what if is this a chicken or egg issue I've heard before, where mm-hmm. people say, well, I don't feel appreciated. I'm not making enough money. No one else is working as hard as I do. So why bother?
Right.
So what do you say to that person?
I say, you're living in a bubble. And that if you think you're the only one that feels that way, that narcissistic, you know, people think that narcissism is like the president of the United States narcissism. It's not. Narcissism is you can be a negative person and always think that you're not getting the fair end of the stick. But that's narcissism, too. When you think anything's about you, it's all about you. You're not treated. You're part of the problem.
Okay, so to wrap up, Tom, yep. if you've done everything in your power to look at yourself and see what you can do better, yep. and it's still not working out, then what do you do?
If you've given it and you're sure you've given it your fair shake, then put a resume together and think about what you want that you're not getting. You have to know about what you want and what you're not getting. And at the very least, you need to know what you don't want. What are the traits of that company and that manager that you don't want at the new place? And if you don't cross those T's and dot that I's, you're going to run into the same problem again.
We should talk about that. What to look for when you're looking for a new job. That's a better fit
we'll
for
do
you
it next
time. Okay. Thanks so much to CEO of LaSalle Network, Tom Gimbel. Thanks so much for being in studio. A lot more coming up on WGN Radio, including a co-founder of Cards Against Humanity. G here with a Winterest Business Lunch. Have you ever played the game Cards Against Humanity? If you haven't, I'm sure somebody in your family has. It actually started right here in Chicago through a Kickstarter campaign in 2010. Really has carved out its own niche with a popular party game. It's known for its politically incorrect, cutting-edge humor. And they were making business news this week because they have now purchased a parody website by the name of Clickhole. Here to explain it all is the co-founder of Cards Against Humanity, Max Temkin. Hi, Max.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being with us. So tell us why you decided to purchase this parody website, Clickhole.
Yeah, so Clickhole was started at The Onion, which is the satirical news website, long-running satirical news website that's based in Chicago. And Clickhole's a little different than The Onion. It's sort of a parody of internet news. You know, it's kind of they parody sort of BuzzFeed style, like listicles and quizzes and things like that. And they're really known for this very sort of off-kilter, absurdist type of humor. And among the sort of comedy scene and comedy nerds, and certainly for myself, I think a lot of people think it's the funniest thing that's out there right now.
These listicles and quizzes are really big money makers for websites.
Yeah, I don't... I guess that's all relative, right? Because I don't know that any news websites are, like, making that much money. But, you know, Clickhole's doing, they're doing, how would I even, it's such a weird thing to describe. It's somewhere in between written comedy and, you know, and satire and performance art, because they're also sort of inhabiting this character of this website that just wants clicks. They just want attention. They want to, you know, break the internet with this viral content. So it's a little bit of a parody of that whole style as well.
That's why they're called clickbait, because they just get you to click. And then, of course, these listicles and quizzes always get sent to me via text by someone who says, check this out. This is pretty amazing.
Well, and they, and you know, again, ClickHole is making fun of this, and they're doing a sort of a satirical version of it. But, you know, when they first launched, they had this click counter on the bottom of the website, and it just went up by one every time you click, and you could unlock certain achievements by clicking more and more. I mean, this thing is like, it's very weird, and it's very brilliant. And, you know, I know for all of us at Cards Against Humanity, like, we're longtime readers of this site, and we love it, and we love the team there. And, yeah, it's a great fit for us, and it's something that we're really passionate about.
Talking with co-founder of Cards Against Humanity, Max Temkin, the particulars of the deal, undisclosed price. It was an all cash deal. Why was this such a perfect marriage for you guys?
Yeah, so ClickHole's run was created by comedy writers, and it's a bunch of comedians and sort of creative people. And they're doing this sort of new comedic medium. But over their tenure at Onion Inc., and then I think they were part of the Gawker Media Group, and now they're owned by this company, Geo Media, they've had all these sort of new owners and shakeups and restructurings. And, you know, I'm sure anyone who's worked in news can tell you how disruptive that is to the sort of normal creative process. And we're just fans of this thing, and we just want them to be able to write comedy. And, you know, ClickHole's had its ups and downs, and, you know, more recently they've lost a lot of their staff and resources. And so we stepped in and started talking to the owner, Geo Media, and we said, hey, instead of kind of letting this thing dwindle, what if we took it over and worked with them to keep it going? And it's basically as simple as that. We've set up a sort of a new entity with them where it's going to be employee controlled. So they own the vast majority of the company, and we just want them to keep making this kind of weird original comedy that they're known for.
So this is all for the greater good of comedy's sake.
I wish I could tell you that we had a plan to make millions of dollars on this thing, but it's really just because it makes us laugh, and we think it can be sustainable. And we just want this website to be around for 100 years. And it's also a great, you know, it's a small world, right? Of people who make their living, you know, making comedy. And to me, these are the best. This is just my personal opinion. They're just the best living people at it. So it's really exciting just to get to work with them.
But my goodness, Max, hasn't Cards Against Humanity come a long way? Are you impressed by what you've accomplished with your team?
It's a little weird. It feels a little weird and surreal. You know, I started Cards with seven of my childhood friends, and none of us ever had a plan in our lives that we were going to make this like best-selling comedy card game. Like I'm very grateful for the success of the game, but it's just been this crazy like rocket ship that we're hanging onto the back of. Like, you know, it's been really weird and surprising that it's taken off. And you know, I think back to like in the early days of Cards, you know, when we had seen that this thing was going to be successful. There were all these resources and mentorship and help that I felt like we needed. And, you know, sometimes people would reach out and they would help us along. And I just never forget how much that meant to me. And we're very, very fortunate that we're in a position now to offer that kind of help to other people who are, you know, trying to start their own projects.
So now you own a parody website. And also I'm hearing that there is soon going to be a board game cafe in your future.
That's right. Yeah, I wish for newsmaking purposes these things were not all happening in the same week, but this is one of our other long-term dreams. There's this type of thing that exists like overseas and in some cities in the U.S. called board game cafes, and the idea is that it's like a restaurant where you can go and have a beer and have some food, and you sit with your friends and play a board game, and you can meet other people who like board games. And we always felt like there should be a world-class, you know, high-end, amazing place to play board games and have dinner in Chicago, so we're making it. It's called the Chicago Board Game Cafe. I think we just announced that we are opening February 14th, so this Valentine's Day, and we'll be in the Wicker Park neighborhood by the same building as Margie's Candies. I invite people to come by. Whether people love board games or if they just want to come and check it out and learn, come by for dinner. We'll have great food and it'll be a really fun time.
Well, thank you so much to Max Temkin, co-founder of Cards Against Humanity. Really appreciate you joining Winter's Business Lunch. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.